Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Such pleasure to have you with us. And I'm delighted to have back Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, infectious disease specialist. Dr. Schreiner, very good morning to you.
Good morning, Larry.
First of all, how is Huntington looking with its number of patients under treatment for COVID-19?
Well, we're coming down like most hospitals, and so I think it's that's optimistic. I was just telling one of your producers that one of my patients is going home in the next day or two, so that's always a great thing for the nurses and for the staff. So we are seeing a decline. Our ICU has also seen a decline, so that's good. You know, we just have to be very nimble. We've got to be able to get ready for the next surge, which I'm sure there will be one, hopefully later rather than sooner. But, you know, it's hard to see what's going to happen with the holiday here. So,
yeah, I'm just looking at a story that Italy has registered a new surge in coronavirus infections, rising by more than 1,300 today. That was up from close to 1,000 on Tuesday. So, you know, even countries that feel like they're well past the crisis are still having to be on guard for this.
Yeah, it really, you just have to be very flexible. This is an extremely infectious pathogen. We've been, this is the nature of the beast is that every time we try to dip our toe in the water of kind of assuming normal activities, it comes back. And so we just have to be prepared for that and know what to do, which we do know what to do, which is to, you know, social distance and wear masks. And I think if we can keep the heights of the surges down, that will be an accomplishment until we have some good therapy or a vaccine.
Again, your questions for Dr. Schreiner at 866-893-KPCC. You can tweet at AirTalk, post on our Facebook page, or post on the AirTalk page, which is at kpcc.org, 866-893-5722. A new study that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association today showed that in multiple studies involving a total of 1,700 patients, a number of corticosteroids, those are anti-inflammatory drugs that can dampen the effects of an overactive immune system, helped reduce COVID-19 deaths by about a third compared with patients who didn't receive steroids. I recall, Dr. Schreiner, that we talked previously about you're using corticosteroids with your clients, with your patients, and seeing some positive results.
That's right, Larry. It's really become sort of a quote-unquote standard protocol for most of our patients to receive some type of corticosteroids. We usually use dexamethasone, but occasionally we use different varieties of that. The tricky part is kind of when in the stage of their infection do we use it. Most of the patients now are pretty much getting it when they come into the hospital. In the grand scheme of things, it's a pretty safe therapy, but we don't really know is it helpful at the very early stages of the disease to try to tamp down the all of the inflammation that's going on, or is it something that we should use more in the later stages. The recovery trial, which was the big trial that was done in England, the first trial that showed the benefit of steroids, was used mostly in very critical ill patients. But I think we're learning as we go along that the more we can kind of try to intervene earlier, the less kind of morbidity we see down the road.
So could that mean that using the steroid even before the lungs are heavily involved could ward off serious lung complications?
There seems to be some data that suggests that. The only problem is that corticosteroids themselves suppress the immune system, and we do want to have the immune system to be able to respond somewhat to the infection. That's how you naturally get rid of the infection. So we have to be very careful in using the steroids, in the timing of the use of the steroids. But yes, we hope that it prevents some of the deleterious stuff that happens with COVID down the road, and especially in the lungs.
All right. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Los Angeles County is considering allowing hair salons and barbershops to resume cutting and working with hair indoors, but with limited capacity. Dr. Schreiner, would you support that reopening with smaller capacity inside?
Inside always makes me nervous. We still have an awful lot of disease out in the community, and so I know it's when we see these downturns in the number of cases in hospitals and in the number of cases in the county, everybody sort of gets optimistic, but I also think people begin to let their guard down a little bit. And although we all want to have a haircut, outside is still a whole lot better. So if some of these salons can accommodate that, that's a great way to go. Inside, you're going to have to really limit the number of people you have in there. And, you know, that's a pretty close contact when you're giving a haircut. So you, those people need to be masked pretty well and be very, very cautious.
866-893-KPCC. Andrew in Brea asked Dr. Schreiner, do you think there will be an expansion of the number of healthcare professionals allowed to administer a vaccine once it becomes available?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the, you know, we hope that there's sort of an organized and appropriate plan for vaccination. We don't know whether the vaccine is going to be a one-shot or perhaps a two-shot. Some of the studies are using a booster idea. And it really does need to be a pretty much centrally, federally guided organization. We've not done so well with that throughout this pandemic in this country. But I think that that's really going to be important so that we address the vulnerable populations first and then begin to really spread the use of the vaccine in an organized and very efficient way. And that's going to require some very careful planning.
Is it possible, or do you know, are any of the vaccines being tested for oral administering?
Not right now, Larry. You know, it's possible. Oral vaccines are not very common. The polio one, of course, is perhaps the most common one.
I remember those sugar cubes when I was a little kid.
Exactly. Yeah, you and I remember that. But it's not a very common modality because a lot of the material is denatured when it passes through the digestive system. So most vaccines are what we call intramuscular injections, and I think that that's a more efficient way of doing it. Plus, you know you're really getting the material in to stimulate the immune system and create immunity.
866-893-KPCC. Bob and Downey asks about opening of public libraries. Said I would think it would be easier to maintain social distance at a library than an office. There are many students attending online classes that could really benefit from working at libraries. Would it be safe for libraries to reopen?
Well, I think, you know, libraries are so very essential in our communities, and libraries have, for the last several years, have really been having sort of to struggle. But I think that those are venues. They're usually relatively large buildings. Again, if you can create an environment where people are pretty spread out and you have a population that's going to respect those distances, then I think that's a possibility. I would sort of certainly like to see libraries and schools begin to open up before we see bars, for example, where we know there's a lot of spread of virus and so forth. So, but I think, again, all of these venues, whether it's an educational gathering or a social gathering, those have to be, we have to watch what happens when we do it. And you can see an uptick. You have to expect an uptick no matter what we do, but it's going to have to be a little bit carefully done.
And what would be the best way to ventilate those spaces like libraries? Would it be to have all the doors, and if there are windows that opened, and use fans, or to use the HVAC system? What's the best way to cut down on transmission?
Well, the best way is to create what we call negative airflow so that it's vented to the outside. And that can be achieved usually just by opening up windows and doors. You have to be a little careful with ventilation systems like HVAC systems because they may, depending on how the air is moved through the room, they may or may increase the potential for transmission. Fans are sort of a sticky wicket in terms of whether they can blow some of infected material into other venues and towards other people. But those also can be helpful especially if you have an open window or something like that to kind of channel the airflow out that way.
I'm feeling very at home hearing your dog barking in the background. The other day I was broadcasting Friday at home, and of course my dog right at the end of the show starts barking. I thought that she was so at the other end of the house, but it's not that far. We're talking with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, Huntington Hospital infectious disease specialist. Your questions at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Sarah in Santa Monica with an interesting sort of theoretical question. What is the purpose of a virus in nature? Dr. Schreiner?
That's an excellent question, Sarah. So viruses actually serve a purpose. Actually, about 10 to 15% excuse me, of our genome is actually made up of old viruses, and indeed actually retroviruses, which are the kind of progenitors for HIV. So viral pathogens have emerged along with us evolutionarily the entire time, and they often become ingrained in our genetic material. Whether they serve any purpose or not, we don't know. We think that sometimes viruses help bolster the immune system and help sort of transform the immune system so that it can fight off other types of infections. That could be a possibility. Immunity to these viruses may trigger different kinds of responses in the environment. So they probably do have some evolutionary purpose. And they certainly function and are important in the ecology of the planet. So eradicating viruses would not be a good thing to do. But the problem is that when you have a new virus that comes along where the host, in this case humans, have no immunity, then it can cause a lot of damage. And so as we evolve in the next few years dealing with this virus, it's likely that this virus will become a little less nasty, and as more people develop immunity, it will become more part of our sort of genetic material and less part of our pathology.
Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, although I probably don't have to introduce you, probably know her voice by now. She joins us regularly as part of our team of physicians, infectious disease specialists joining us. She's with Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. Steve tweets at AirTalk, since PCR-based COVID-19 tests are so sensitive, do we have any idea yet what proportion of new COVID cases are actually shedding enough virus to infect another individual?
That's a great question. And we don't know what the sort of inoculum size has to be. Most of the tests that we do not measure viral load, which is a term we use for HIV. We know in HIV, for example, when your viral load falls below a certain level, that you probably are no longer infectious. And we don't really have that data yet on this virus, but that is going to be an important one to achieve, to sort of get an idea of how much virus you have to be infectious. The length of time that you're infectious also still seems to be a little bit unclear. Most people, the course of the illness is about 14 days. But we do know that there are people, of course, who are asymptomatic spreaders at the beginning of the infection. They don't have any symptoms, and they're actually very efficient at spreading the virus. And we also have seen individuals who continue to shed virus many weeks after they got over their illness. Now, whether they're still infectious or not, we don't know.
All right. We also have a large study of antibodies, which shows some very positive results for vaccine development. This came out yesterday from Iceland, tests on more than 30,000 Iceland residents, most extensive study yet of immune system response to the novel coronavirus over time. Your thoughts on the results here?
Very good news. I think that's an excellent study. And I just want to commend you, Larry, for always bringing up very relevant and somewhat complicated science articles, because it's so important to follow the science with this disease and to do studies like they did in Iceland. That was a large study with 30,000 people, and they did show that antibodies were robust after a fairly long period of time. So that's going to be very important. That's very good news. That's part of the humoral of the immune system, which are the antibodies that neutralize the virus. And that's mainly what these vaccines will produce first. Now, we also have the cellular immune system, the more adaptive part of our immune system, and we hope that the vaccines also stimulate that. But this is kind of the first glimmer of good news I think we've had in a while. Now, you have to be a little careful, because the population in Iceland is different than some of the populations around the world. They tend to be a healthier population. But that was a large study that did show persistence of neutralizing antibodies, so I think it's encouraging.
Just amazing to me how our listeners have become so knowledgeable about the virus. Mark asked this question. There was talk early on of one vaccine being developed to recognize only the surface of the virus instead of the spikes, therefore might be less susceptible to virus evolution. Is that vaccine still being studied?
There are smaller studies looking at vaccines that are, as Mark described, that are aimed at different parts of the virus. And I do think it's good to have a diverse selection of vaccines, because it's entirely possible that right now all of the big major vaccines that are being produced are directed towards the spike protein. So I think that if that fails, then we certainly need to have a backup position. I don't know the status of what phase some of those vaccines are being developed. The spike protein is clearly one of the most important parts of viral attachment, and that's why it's been the target for vaccine development. I just was attending an excellent lecture at Occidental where we're teaching a course, and my shout out to our students over there because we were just discussing the importance of the spike protein. But I agree, your listeners have become very good virologists.
They really have a handle on some complex science here. Renee posts on our Facebook page, I'm curious about the new California color-coded map and reopening criteria. How does the state's current system compare with local counties' reopening criteria / markers and the past ones? Will we repeat the open maybe too soon and then have to close down again?
It's all an experiment. You know, we've never been here before, at least this generation. And so I think each of these systems are being looked at. Most counties tend to try to parallel what the state is recommending, but some of it is dependent on their own particulars in that county. If they have a larger portion of vulnerable populations, or if they have different kinds of economic needs where they have to consider opening different things sooner, it depends if they're agricultural, if they're urban. So there's lots of factors in the county. The county health departments have a lot of power, and they are very facile at trying to kind of adapt the state recommendations to what their particular needs will be. But none of us really know the best way of doing this. I think we did. I think Governor Newsom felt, and I think it turned out to be true, that we opened too quickly the last time we were in this situation. So we have to be very, very careful. And again, different counties have different needs, so it's up to the public health departments to try to address those.
All right. So many questions we don't have time to, but we'll carry these over to future days. Dr. Schreiner, always such a pleasure. Thank you very much. And we appreciate you and your colleagues at Huntington Hospital so much for the daily work you're doing.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you. Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, Pasadena's Huntington Hospital, where she's infectious disease specialist. Coming up, we'll talk about Long Beach moving a step closer to a pilot program providing a universal basic income to a sector of its residents. We'll talk with the mayor of Long Beach and former Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang, who has long been espousing the benefits of universal basic income. We'll be back in just 90 seconds on Air Talk.